About Amos, the reluctant prophet. I think Joseph did an outstanding job of reading these verses about that plumb line. We may not know what a plumb line is, but if you've been in ancient building techniques, you'd understand. It's so important that the walls of a city or the walls of a house go up straight. It's not strong if it's not built straight. And so there'd be this string and there'd be a weight on the end of it, and you'd just hold that string up, and guess what? God's going to measure it, make that gravity, pull that string down straight every time. And if the wall is not parallel to the string, guess who's at fault? It's not God and His plumb line. It's whoever's building the wall. And Amos says, God showed me a plumb line drawn up against the house of Israel. And it's not straight. And that's who Amos is. But before we look at the book itself, let's talk a little bit about what a prophet is. That definition of a prophet, the word literally means to speak forth. One of the questions we had that we didn't get to answer, one of those questions and answers night was, what's the definition of a prophet? Literally it means to speak forth or to speak far, to speak on behalf. In fact, There's an illustration of this in relationship to Moses and Aaron. You remember God called Moses to be His prophet? And Moses' answer was, I cannot speak. And so God said, that's no problem. We'll get your brother to be your spokesman. And so when you go before Pharaoh, Aaron can be your spokesman. Now, if you want a biblical definition of a prophet, look in Exodus chapter 7, verse 1 and 2, where the Lord says to Moses, I have made you as a God to Pharaoh, and Aaron, your brother, shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron, your brother, shall speak to Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of the land. Who's the prophet here? Aaron? Who in this illustration is God? Moses. There's a message that needs to be conveyed from Moses over here to Pharaoh. Standing between Moses and Pharaoh is Aaron, and Aaron is called a prophet. That's what a prophet is. There is God who has a message to give to mankind. And the spokesman between God and mankind is a prophet. And so when we talk about Amos as being a prophet, all we're talking about is that man who stood between God and the people speaking on behalf of God. We need to understand the importance of prophets in the Bible. In fact, to illustrate that, we need to understand that their message was not something that originated with them, but they were messengers that were carried along, are borne along by the Spirit of God. Listen to 2 Peter chapter 1. Holy men of God spake, or the prophecy never came by the will of man, but holy men of God spake as they were moved by the Spirit. Darren, if we wanted to move you tonight, we could do it. I could get one of my grandmother's old hat pins, and I could walk up behind you without you being aware that I was there, and I could move you. I wouldn't have any control over where you were going, but I guarantee you that long hat pin she used to wear had to be 4 feet long. And she, I always wonder why they didn't stick it in their brains when they stuck it in their hair to keep it in place. But give me that hat pin, and I could move you. That's not the Greek word that's here. If there were enough of us, we could move you. We could get a couple of guys, grab you by the ears and a couple by the arms and a couple by the legs and a couple by your front pockets and a couple by your nose holes, and we could move you. If there are enough of us, you wouldn't have any control over where you went. Guess which of these words is found here in relationship to the prophet? It's the second word. Holy men of God spake as the Spirit of God carried them. Borne along by the Spirit of God. A prophet is simply God's messenger carried along by the Spirit of God. Now, the work of the prophet, that also indicates the importance of them because they were the ones who delivered God's warnings. In Zechariah chapter 7, Zechariah says, yes, they, talking about the Jews, made their hearts like flint, refusing to hear the law and the words which the Lord of hosts had sent by His Spirit through the former prophets. There it is again. Even though they would not listen, God gave not His message, gave not His word, but God gave the words in the plural. And these words were sent by the Spirit through the prophets. That's why these prophets were so important. When they refused to hearken, the rest of the verse says, the great wrath came from the Jehovah of hosts, from the Lord of hosts. Therefore it happened that just as He had proclaimed and they would not hear, so they called out and I would not listen, says the Lord of hosts. And understand and emphasize again what we've just read, and that is a failure to listen to the prophets resulted in the destruction of the nations. When you began talking about the work of the prophet, and more especially the importance of the prophets, recognize that when they refused to listen to God, destruction awaited them. When the northern kingdom of Israel had fallen, in 2 Kings chapter 17, we read these words. The Lord testified against Israel, that's the northern kingdom, and against Judah, by all of His prophets, every seer, saying, here's the message of all of the prophets that God sent. Turn from your evil ways and keep My commandments and My statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent by you by My servants the prophets. Nevertheless, they would not hear, but they stiffened the neck like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. And they rejected His statutes and His covenants which He had made with their fathers and His testimony which He had testified against them. They followed idols, they became idolaters and went after the nations who were around them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them. So they left all of the commandments of the Lord their God made for themselves molten images and two calves, made a wooden image and worship all the host of heavens and serve Baal. They caused their sons to pass through the fire, practice witchcraft and soothsaying, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoke Him to anger. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from His sight. And there was none left but Judah alone. You understand the importance of the prophets? That whenever we get to the time of the prophets, that a failure to listen to these prophets led to the destruction of the nation. Here's something Israel did not know, and that is that the heroes of the Old Testament were not the heroes that they picked out. They thought the most important people on this earth were their kings, but the heroes of the Old Testament, in the estimation of God, were these prophets. And that's emphasized so importantly in the book of Hosea. Just right before the fall of that northern kingdom of Israel, Hosea comes and he says, I gave you a king in My anger, and I took away your king in My wrath. God never wanted them to have the kings. It was rebellion against God for them to ever set up a king on this earth. And God said, I was angry at you when you did it. And the Lord said, and I've taken him away. But hear him again in this same book, just a few verses before these words in chapter 13, when he says, it was by a prophet that the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt. And it was by a prophet that he was preserved. Not King David, not King Hezekiah, not King Jehoshaphat, not King Josiah. Those are not the heroes of God in the Old Testament. The heroes of God in the Old Testament were the prophets. And that's why when we get over into the time of the prophets there in the Old Testament, we're at the time whenever God has his heroes there in abundance. Who's the first man called a prophet in the Old Testament? Who would you say? Abraham. Abraham is the first man that the Bible describes as a prophet. We don't usually think about him as being a prophet, but he was a mouthpiece for God. As far as we know, the first man who did the work of a prophet had to be Noah. For 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5 says that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. If his message came from God, and where else could the message come except from God? For there was no written message at that time. Noah was the first to do the work of the prophet. I find it interesting that in Acts chapter 3, when Peter begins to talk about the prophets, he says, "And all the prophets from Samuel onward, as many as have spoken, have likewise foretold of these days." But it's really when you get to the time of Elijah and Elisha that you begin to read about the school of the prophets and about the abundance of the prophets that were there. And from the time of Elijah and Elisha until the end of the Old Testament, there never is a time when God does not have a prophet, someone to speak for him, some individual to whom God can give his message, and that messenger is there. And so we look at the time of the prophets, and perhaps the best way to describe them is that the time of the abundance of them begins with Elijah and Elisha, and it's the miracles of Elijah and Elisha that authenticate all of the messages of all of the prophets who come afterwards, though they themselves may not be the performer of miracles. And so that brings us to Amos, the reluctant prophet, the man who never planned to be a prophet, the unexpected prophet. Amos describes himself as being not a prophet, nor was he the son of a prophet. Those are the words that Joseph read to us earlier in this service. Amos is the unexpected prophet because he was a herdsman who also spent part of the time gathering the fruit from a sycamore tree, to use the words of the King James. He wasn't a prophet. But when the God of heaven came to Amos, beyond a shadow of a doubt, Amos was ready to speak for God. While it is not in that sense that God calls us to be prophets, in the sense that he's going to give us a new revelation, God calls upon each of us to be aware of the loss that are around us, and for us to speak the word of God to them. And while we may be neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, when God calls us to speak for others, we don't have any choice about it. Let's take just a few minutes and look at this amazing book, the book of Amos. Amos speaks. And in the very first verse of the first chapter, like in almost all of the books of prophets, you can read exactly when that individual lived. And so Amos chapter 1 verse 1 says, "The words of Amos, who was among the sheep breeders of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. And then he nails it down to a specific time that we cannot know, but those individuals who read his writings would readily remember it was 2 years before the earthquake. I think it's amazing how we ourselves even date things by natural events. Were you down here whenever Andrew hit? Were any of you here when David came through? We take natural disasters and use them as markers in our lives. In the absence of calendars, it was those natural disasters that would nail that down in its entirety. When we read in chapter 1 and verse 1 that he prophesied during the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah, and Jeroboam, this is Jeroboam the second, not Jeroboam the son of Nebat, but Jeroboam the son of Joash, a second king named Jeroboam. When we read about him being king of Israel, we know that we're living during the time of the divided kingdom. You may recall that after the death of Solomon, the kingdom was divided into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And so here's Amos. He's from the village of Tekoa. And he lives during that time when there is that Jewish nation, but that nation is divided. And sometimes they're involved in civil war, one against the other. During the time of Uzziah. And during the time of Joash. The life of Amos allows him to live at the time of others of the prophets who are his contemporaries. For example, here is another prophet who prophesied in the days of Uzziah. You know who that is? Oh, that's Isaiah. I flip over a few pages in the Bible, and again, I read of another individual who was a prophet during the time of Uzziah. Who's that? Oh, that's Micah. And so our concept ought not to be that just because we have in the latter part of the Bible listed oftentimes chronologically when they lived the books of the prophets, it does not mean that one followed another, but many times they stood side by side. And so here's Micah, and here's Isaiah down in that southern kingdom prophesying. And then there's Amos. He's also a southern prophet. But look and pay attention to the fact that Amos made a journey. Amos goes from Tekoa up to Bethel. That means nothing to us. But had we lived at this time, we would have been able to know that Tekoa was a village in that southern kingdom. Tekoa was a village about 8 miles from Bethlehem, which we may recognize as not being far at all from Jerusalem. Bethel is famous. Bethel is the place where when that northern kingdom began, one of the golden calves was erected there. It's in the southern part of that northern kingdom. It's still north of Tekoa. The other golden calf was put up at Dan, some way up in the northern part of that northern kingdom. But here is Amos, and he goes from the south up to the north. It's amazing that while God oftentimes called prophets from the north to prophesy to the northern kingdom, like Hosea, Amos is a renegade. Amos is from the south, and he goes from that southern kingdom up to that northern kingdom to prophesy. And when he gets there, people love the preaching of Amos. And so on the screen we have the words, preach, Amos, preach. Amos' message had to be so wonderful and loved by the people when he gets up there and starts preaching. Take out that pew Bible or open your own Bible and look at this great message that Amos is there preaching. Why, he begins in verse 3 by talking about the sins of the city of Damascus and the fact that the judgment of God, because of those evil people up in Damascus, the judgment of God is about ready to come against Damascus. That means very little to us, but to those people in that northern kingdom, just immediately north of them is the nation of Syria. And the nation of Assyria had been a thorn in the side of that northern kingdom, and they oftentimes would make raids and come down against that northern kingdom. And here's Amos, and he stands there and he preaches and he says, I want you to know that God is angry with what Damascus has done, and God is ready to bring judgment against Damascus, against Syria, and mentions even one of the Jewish cities, Gilead. You remember what those Syrians did, and those Arabs came down, and now God's ready to bring judgment against them. Preach, Amos, preach. The people of that northern kingdom had said, we just love to hear this man preach. And so not only does he talk about Damascus, he then talks about these Philistines. They're over there on the seacoast. And who has not read Jewish history enough to know of what a great enemy of the Jews the Philistines often were? And so he says, there are three or four transgressions of Gaza, and God is ready to bring his judgment against these Philistines. Preach, Amos, preach. I love to hear Amos preach. Said those individuals in that northern kingdom, we assume, because listen to what he's saying. We love to hear this guy preach. And then from Gaza, he turns his attention to the Phoenicians, to the city of Tyrus. Verse 9 and 10, for three or four transgressions of the sins of the Phoenicians, God is ready to bring judgment against those Phoenicians. There's that area just north of that northern kingdom. There's that great nation of Phoenicia that gave us the alphabet and were the merchant shipmen of the ancient world. And God looks at them and says, they're evil and I'm ready to bring judgment against them. My, oh my, what a great preacher Amos is. People in the north would love to hear this kind of preaching. And then he turns to the Edomites. And they're down south, they're over around the Dead Sea. But at one time they'd been the enemies of the Jews and had fought against the Jews. And the Lord says through Amos the prophet, the judgment of God is ready to come against the Edomites and then against their cousins down in verse 13, the Ammonites. God is angry at all of these nations that are there, and God is ready to bring his judgment against all of these nations that are there. Preach, Amos, preach. We just love to hear Amos preach. Listen to what a great sermon he's got, he's delivered. Why, God is angry against all of these nations around this northern kingdom of Israel. And then he turns to the Moabites. Chapters 2, verse 1 through 3, he talks about those evil Moabites and all that they've done. Man, oh man, do we love to hear this man preach. And then listen to this southerner. Why, there are those Jews down there, those holier than thou Jews down there in Judah. And in chapter 2, verse 4 beginning, he preaches about the sins of Judah and that God is ready to bring judgment against Judah. Don't you just love to hear Amos preach? Those northerners could have said, why, he tells it like it is. Look at all of the iniquity of all of these people around us. And then all of a sudden, the whole tone of Amos' preaching changes, or the direction of it. And all of a sudden, the attitude becomes, Amos, you quit preaching and started meddling. Because in chapter 2, beginning in verse 5, he begins to talk about the sins of that northern kingdom. So much so, chapter 7 in verse 10, that Amaziah the priest of Bethel, does that mean anything to you? Oh yes, Bethel's where they had the golden calf. Here is that priest that's there at Bethel. And he goes to Jeroboam, the king of Israel, and he says, we've got to put a stop to this man's preaching. Jeroboam, do you understand what he's saying? Here is this southerner up here in this northern land, and he has a conspiracy against this house of Israel. And he's preaching so strongly that the land is not able to bear his words. For Amos says, Jeroboam is going to die by the sword, and Israel will be led away captive from their own on the lands. And then Amaziah says to Amos, Amos, you quit preaching and gone to meddling. You need to leave this place. It's all right for you to stand here and preach about the sins of the Phoenicians and the sins of the Syrians, those in the city of Damascus, and it's all right to preach against the Philistines and the Edomites and the Moabites and the Ammonites. It's even all right, Amos, if you want to preach against those southerners and all the things that's wrong in their life. But Amos, you need to stop preaching about what's happening here in this own area. And so he says, go away, you seer. Flee to the land of Judah. Go back to the south. Go back home. Eat your bread there. And if you want to prophesy, that's all right. But prophesy down in that land. And don't you ever again come up here to Bethel. It's the king's sanctuary. It's the king's residence. And this is where Amos said in the words that Joseph read to us so well, I was not a prophet, nor was I the son of the prophet, but God showed me that plumb line. And because I see the plumb line, I cannot but help but preach this message. We don't have time to look at the entire book of Amos. But I want to point out two things that are lessons that come out of this book. The first one is that formalism, external religion, religion that is only outward and the heart and the soul of man is hardly ever involved in it, has never been accepted by God. I want you to hear that. If there's any message that comes out of the book of Amos, it is this message that God has never accepted worship just because people were doing it. The people in this northern kingdom, in some way, were still trying to worship the God of heaven. Look at three passages of scriptures from Amos chapter 5, Amos chapter 6, and Amos chapter 8. The first one, Amos chapter 5, beginning in verse 20. He's talked about the coming of the day of the Lord, but he says that day, instead of being a day that's wonderful, that'll be a day of darkness. It will not be a day of light. Is it not very dark with no brightness in it? I despise your feast days. I do not savor your sacred assemblies. Though you offer to me burnt offerings, grain offerings, I will not accept them. nor will I regard your fattened peace offerings. Take away from me the noise of the songs, for I will not hear the melody of your stringed instruments. What's happened? Is it wrong to have string instruments? Absolutely not. Is it wrong to have the songs? Absolutely not. Is it wrong to have peace offerings? Absolutely not. Is it wrong to have the grain offering? Absolutely not. Nor the burnt offering. All of these things were things commanded of God. And yet the Lord says, I don't even hear it. Why? Because the life of an ungodly person doing a godly act does not make that godly act acceptable to God. We have described several times the expression, the beauty of holiness. Let us worship God in the beauty of holiness. There's a holy God. There's a holy way to worship. But the third aspect of that, the beauty of holiness in worship, is the holiness of the people who worship God. And while these things were directed to a holy God, and while these things were holy things directed to a holy God, they came up as stench in the nostrils of God. And look at the thing stated in verse 24. Let justice and righteousness, things that were unknown in the lives of those individuals that were there, let justice run down like streams of water, and righteousness like a mighty stream. And when justice and righteousness are coupled with these things, that's not formalism. But worship of God from individuals who are ungodly comes up to God and makes Him sick. It's a stench in His nostrils, to use the word that He uses elsewhere. In chapter 6, woe to you who are at ease at Zion, who trust in Mount Samaria, notable people in the chief nation to whom the house of Israel comes. Go over to Calneh and see, and from there go down to Hamath the Great, and go down to Gath of the Philistines. Are you better than these countries, kingdoms, or is their territory greater than yours? Woe to you who put far off the day of doom, who cause the seat of violence to come near. Woe to you who lie on beds of ivory. Woe to you who stretch out on your couches. Woe to you who eat lambs out of the flock. Woe to you who eat calves from the midst of the stalls. Woe to you who sing idly to the sound of string instruments. Woe to you who invent to yourself musical instruments like David. Folks, these things are not sinful in and of themselves. He's not condemning lying on a bed. He's not condemning eating lambs. He's not condemning eating calves. But woe to those individuals who do these things, who drink wine from the bowls, who anoint themselves with the best ointments. Woe to those individuals who do these things, but are not grieved for the afflictions of Joseph. Doing things even commanded by God brings a woe from God upon us when our hearts are not concerned about the spiritual condition of what's happening among the children of Joseph. And the modern application is obvious in our lives. We don't just come to church. We don't just come to worship. We come to worship a holy God in a holy way, from holy hearts. God has always condemned formalism in worship. And then from chapter 8, the people were saying, When will the new moon come? When will it be past? When will this feast day end in order that we may get out and sell our grain? And the Sabbath day? When will it come to an end that we may trade wheat? When will this happen? And then the Lord said, and those measuring devices that you use, like the ephod, and the measure of money that was designed to be measured by weight, you make the measuring container small, and you demand that the shekel paid to you for that smallness of the grain that you're buying be larger with gold or silver than what a shekel normally is. You falsify the scales with deceit. You go out and buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals and even sell bad wheat. The Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, I will never forget what they're doing. If there's any message we need to learn from Amos, it is the message that formalism is never acceptable to God. And then this book, like all of the minor prophets and even the major prophets, almost all of them, if not every one of them, ends with a message of comfort to those who are trying to live right. That group of individuals is referred to in the Old Testament as the remnant of God. The nation has left God, but there's the remnant. And so this book, when you get over to the last chapter, and we're not going to take time to develop it, but in chapter 9, verse 11, he talks about the time when the tabernacle of David would be erected again, and the Gentiles, verse 12, would be called by his name and would be able to worship God. That verse is not a premillennial verse talking about something that might happen in the future. This very verse is quoted in Acts chapter 15 and applied to the church. God has rebuilt again the tabernacle of David, and the Gentiles, that's us, are allowed to be called by the very name of God. The remnant. God has always had a remnant. Noah is a remnant. After the flood, he's the only part that's left faithful to God. Down in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, there's Lot and his family. When the judgment of God comes against that city, there's the remnant. And when Elijah and Elisha were there in the northern kingdom, so much perturbed that Elijah said, I'm the only one left faithful to God. Even at a time when Elijah himself, the prophet living in that northern kingdom, could not find one other person, God says, Elijah, there's 7,000 people that's there. They're the remnant. And so it was when this southern kingdom fell. There are those young men, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the remnant of those who were faithful. And in the religious world in which we live, there are those who have gone down the road of formalism and tried to make that the way to approach God, but there's still that remnant who comes and worship God out of their heart. And whenever the church may digress, there'll still be that remnant. And when the Lord comes back, there will be that remnant. May God help us not to go with the crowd like so many in that northern kingdom of Israel did, but may we be determined to be that righteous remnant. The way that one lives and becomes a part of that remnant today is to believe in Jesus. to make a decision to follow Jesus as they have never done before, to turn away from themselves and turn to God. And when they've confessed their faith in Jesus, they can be baptized into Christ, into a relationship with Christ, unlike any they've ever had before. And then the Lord just says to them, you live right, you do right, you be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. If you're not ready, should the Lord come now to be among the remnant, won't you make the changes you need to make and let it be known by coming to the front as together we stand and sing. Will you come?